Okay, Abani Gani, everyone. This is Professor Amin Ra, Professor Emeritus, California State University, Long Beach. Longtime professor for 34 years. Former city councilman for the city of Compton, former Compton College Board of Trustees, and former Compton Unified School District Board of Trustees. We want to welcome you, each and every one of you, to the Conscious Corner, where we're going to have a very important discussion about one of our historical personalities. We have a morality to remember. We have a morality to honor those that paved the way for us. And we're going to have this discussion tonight. I want to welcome my brother and friend and colleague, Brother Rasha T. Mascani, who's responsible for this platform under the CNN Community Education Network program, which we are on every Tuesday and Wednesday at 6 p.m., where we have lively discussions. And we really welcome the guest presenter tonight because he's been consistently on, and we'll get to that as I introduce him. Second, we want we have a co-host sometimes. He comes on, and that's with my show, Joe Hembrick, a historian who taught at Compton, and then was in Compton Unified School District, was the first head varsity football coach from Linwood Unified, and commissioned the first unity mural at Centennial High School of Black and Brown people working together. Again, we want to welcome you here to the Conscious Corner, which is a program to speak truth to the people and truth to power. And tonight we're going to have a very lively discussion about the history and legacy of Ernest McBride Sr., who was an icon in the city of Long Beach, who was a pioneer of the civil rights movement in Long Beach during the 60s, and maybe even before that. And we have a lively discussion that's going to be led by his son, Ernest McBride Jr., who rightfully is an archivist of his father's work. He's maintained a steady information and data and newspaper articles and all the beautiful things that his father did in his contribution to all of our liberation, not just his family. Not only that, his family, his father, I got the chance to meet personally. And he was they say dynamite come in small packages. He was a small, short brother, but he was a powerful brother. I mean, very, very powerful. Powerful with love and concern for the community and love and concern for that was what was right. He did a great job with his family. Most of them have turned out to be professionals and hardworking people. If he was an example of anything, it was hard work, him and his wife, and they were just an icon for the family, the families around them to emulate, and they brought prestige to Long Beach as well as a historical dynamic that can never be forgotten. And we stand on his shoulders and many other civil rights pioneers' shoulders to enjoy the rights that they struggled for. And some people don't know about them. And we say, why our kids don't know their history? Because we don't tell them. And this is why we decided to have Ernest McBride Jr. talk about his father tonight. Ernest McBride is a longtime Long Beach resident, archive, as I said, and have a vivid memory of all the struggles in Long Beach. We've talked, he's been on our show and he's given us a rundown of the various people that his father touched bases with and that he has touched bases with. Like we really were charmed by the fact that he said Malcolm X came to Long Beach and he had a chance to be a part of that. And so without further delay, we're gonna let Ernest McBride Jr. tell you more about himself and tell you about his father, and then other family members that's on or friends, yeah, be able to chime in also and give some comments. Brother Ernest, take it.
Okay, thank you. Good evening, everyone. And my brother Carl is here to give me a little support. But I kind of
show up when I give support.
Yeah, I usually, when I talk about our dad, we usually try to start from the time he was born. You know, he was born in Carrollton, North Carrollton, Mississippi, in 1909, November 12th. And he was a twin, and he had seven members of his family. He had an older brother, older sister named Eddie, and she's going to play an important role in this discussion too. And then he had a brother, older brother named Cliff, and another one named Helen, an older sister Helen, and a brother Webb over him. And then he and his sister Sally were twins, and I never knew which one was the oldest. But then they had a younger brother, George. And they had the family had a kind of a struggle coming up, because between 1909 and 1918, the TB kind of ran through the family. And so it took his brother out, his oldest brother and the younger one, and then his sister, his twin sister, who was Sally. But it was the mother and father survived, and also his older sister Eddie and his brother Webb. But he had TB like all of his life. He test positive, because our family used to have to go to the health department and take tests, because he's lived behind us and we were always around him. But Eddie and Webb and my dad were the survivors of the family. So, and I remember he told me in 1918, they had a flu epidemic that kind of took out a lot of America. And the whole family caught the flu except his brother Webb. And they had a horse, he said, because they were living on a farm. They had a horse that was big enough to carry two people. So Webb had to ride into town, get the doctor. The doctor drove his Model A out as far as he could without getting bogged down in the mud. And then he had to get out of the car and get on the horse with Webb and bring him to the house. And my dad said the doctor spent like 5 days with them curing the family. So that was one episode that they had. And then right after that, his brother used to work. They moved. The mother had said, well, I'm going to do it on the next good crop we have, because they didn't share a crop. And then that, the reason they didn't have to was, I'll explain a little later, but was due to their sister Eddie. So anyway, they didn't. So the mother, she self-taught them in school, and said that the next good crop they had, that was around 1910, she said, we're going to sell out and move to Arkansas, because I want my kids to have a formal education, because she self-taught everybody. You know, my grandmother self-taught them all, but she wanted them to go to a regular school. So that's when they moved to Little Rock, because that was the closest school that blacks could attend. There were no schools in Mississippi for blacks. So once they got to Little Rock, he, you know, attended Scipio Jones High School. And then my brothers had some communications back and forth, you know, trying to present our dad. And they got him in their little archives there as a hero of the school because of Carl. So, but anyway, in 1927, I think that the thing that got him on the road to civil rights was that his brother Webb, which is about 2 years older, my 2.5 years, he worked at a Greek restaurant. And, you know, Arkansas had a black downtown district and a separate white one. So his brother worked in the black district in this Greek restaurant. And my dad was on his way. He'd go there every evening and come home with him. And so he went in the restaurant and he was sitting there waiting on him, and he heard this big row outside, people howling and screaming and yelling. And about that time, he said a white gentleman ran in there and in the restaurant, closed the door and pulled the curtains down and told him, say, don't go out there, say, because they're looking for a black person to hang. And so they were kind of peeking through the curtain, and he remembers vividly seeing this 1927 ragtop Ford driving up and down the street, and they had a chain hooked to the back bumper, and they had a human body hooked around the body's neck, and they was dragging it up and down the street. And then another parade of cars was following in behind, blowing the horn and, you know, kicking up a big rigmarole that he used to call it. And say they finally, after several times of going up and down the street, they stopped at the intersection. There's a big colored church, a big church on the corner, and they broke in the church and pulled the pews out, bust, you know, and put them out in front of the intersection, got gasoline and started the fire, and they threw the gentleman's body on the fire and burned. He said it was just sickening. You could smell burning flesh and everything. And he said, I couldn't, and people were standing around, a couple of hundred people. And I had found out about that. I, you know, was looking at it on the internet. The gentleman's name was John Carter. And found out later what had happened was Mr. Carter was kind of mentally challenged. And he used to hang out in the woods, like, and get up in tree and scare people or whatever. And they say this white lady and her daughter were coming down the road in a wagon. And Mr. Carter jumped out of the wagon, and he scared the woman, scared the horse. And she hurt her arm or something, at least she claims. And she goes back in the town and say, well, he attacked me. So some of the white people knew where he stayed at. And they ran out and captured him, and they hung him to a telephone post, and that was the body behind the car. And I noticed in Little Rock there, I just downloaded something where they got a memorial in the town about Mr. Carter and telling what happened to him, you know, unjust hanging. So I think that my dad, he would very rarely mention that, but when he would, he would say, well, that was just sickening. It was always on his mind. So about a week or so later, he was coming to meet his brother again, and he heard some screaming, people screaming and hollering. So he ran to this clearing, and it was a gentleman, one of those old coal-burning stoves, wood-burning stoves that blew up. And it caught these two kids on fire, and they were running out in the yard every time. And their father would catch one of them and try to put it out. And then he would have to jump up and go catch the other one. And then this fire would restart. So my dad jumped in there and grabbed one of the kids, and he helped smother the crime. So he kind of felt elated after that. And but this thing about Mr. Carter was kind of always on his mind. So at Scipio Jones High School, they did a lot of international politics. So they learned about Mahatma Gandhi and who was going back to Africa movement. What was the name? Marcus Garvey. Yeah. So he started studying that. And then I think around 29 or so, he played a year with the Memphis Red Sox. He and his friend, Reverend Reddick, and they, but they didn't hardly ever get to play during the summer because they were the new guys on the team, and he say rode the bench most of the time. But then they decided to come to California, and then that's when I got a picture of my Aunt Eddie, where the thing about her, he wouldn't really tell me, but what happened, my grandmother worked for this white couple called the Porters, and she was like 14 years old, and she came up pregnant. So the Porter that owned white guy, they were white couple, he owned the farm where they worked, so he hired Grant McBride, that's my dad's father. So they hired him. He was 21, she was 14. So when she come up pregnant, you can see misogynation there, because she looks white. She could pay everybody, you know, everybody, when you see her, you think she's a white woman. So that was the thing my dad, he would say, well, we had privileges. So that was kind of like, they didn't have to share a crop. I mean, they owned what they grew and they could sell it. And say, because one time he almost got into his dad would always get the first bale of cotton to market. And say, he took it then, he put it on the trestle, you know, because that's what farmers did in that era. You just put it on the trestle for the train and you'd sell it, you know, when the train would come pick it up. So he said, the sheriff come out to his dad and say, the sheriff say, well, Grant, they call his dad Grant, say, because I thought that was your bale of cotton on the trestle. And he said, well, it is. He said, well, some guy, Barnett down there saying that that's his cotton. He said, no, I said, that's my bale of cotton. So the sheriff takes his dad down and said, come on down there, we're gonna kill this. It was a white guy that they didn't like in town, boy, and tried to get his dad, so he'll take my gun and shoot him. He said, no, I'm not touching that gun. And so he went and claimed it, moved it back to his spot, and they came on home. And so that night, that Barnett guy came down, they lived down in a hollow, and he came down there and said, hey, said, I'm gonna say, you guys be here tonight, because my Aunt Eddie was sitting on the one that was half white, she was on the porch, but she wasn't feeling good. So he talking about, get that gal out in the field. He said, well, you own this, you know, the land, but you don't own the crop, because we're renting from you, paying you rent. So what do you, my grandma, because she didn't take no stuff, you know, because I remember her up until I was about 6 years old. So she said, no, said we'd go out there and work when we want to work, not when he saw, all right, I'm going to kill all you niggas tonight. I'm coming down here and so I'm gonna kill every one of us. So say from the main road, it was about a half a mile down in there. And it had a couple of big trees as you come down in that gully. And so he went in town and said, hey, that night, my dad said, well, I think this might be our last night on earth. So if it do, we're gonna go down fighting. So he had a 45 and his brother had a Winchester 30-30, so he was a crack shot. So you go up there and by the tree and let them come down in and don't let nobody get out of here alive. Though. And so we're going to be down at the house. And then my grandmother had a double barrel shotgun and said they was up all night, but nothing ever happened. And that next day, I think they planned, they said, well, we moving to Arkansas, we getting out of Mississippi. So that was a kind of scary thing there for him. But he, you know, he can't decided he come to California. And then my Aunt Eddie kind of came into play there because she, you know, on the way, they didn't have trouble getting food because she could walk in any restaurant in the front door and order the food, bring it out to them. You didn't have to worry about going around the back. So they came on to California, and that was in 1930. And so he had his own car, so he was kind of a sporter. He met some of the guys, formed the baseball team, and they did that, you know, in between for entertainment. And then this lady named Miss Helen Irving had a women's club, and they used to give dances on Saturday nights. So my dad formed the baseball team. And then that was kind of the nucleus of a civil rights thing, because he got a guy named Roscoe Hayes and Nathan Holly, Roscoe Hayes and L.J. Jones and my mom, because to form the NAACP branch in Long Beach, to see him, my mom got met, he met her in about 32. And then they tried to find a place to in Long Beach, which is now predominantly the old ghetto area, and it was like on 20th Street and Lemon. And so they paid the landlord the rent, and they went in and got Clorox and stuff and cleaned it up and everything. Next day, the landlord came and said, "Well, I'm sorry, I can't can't rent to you because the neighbors don't want no blacks living in this neighborhood." And so he said, "I'll give you your deposit back, but I can't pay you for the cleanup that you did." So they couldn't find a place to stay. This was like in 34, because that's when they got married on April 1st, yesterday, 1934. So they ended up had to go to Wilmington, because some guy on the baseball team said, "Hey, Mac, you and your wife looking for a place to stay? There's a place over in Wilmington, you know, right down the street from Banning Park over there." So they went over there and stayed over there about 2 years. And my sister, older sister, was born there in 35, and then I was born in 38. And then I was born February, so in August, somebody on the team saw them say, "Mac, there's a black guy that owns some property in Long Beach that got a house that's be big enough for you and your family. You know, you got two kids," and so we rented down on 19th and Lewis. And so we stayed there, and then he used to always prance around talking about the end of it, because it was real, but the black codes was real bad in Long Beach, because he found out when they married my mother, she said, "Well, I came here in 1923, my grandpa," and said, "We took the train, landed at Union Station," saying grandpa was nowhere to be seen. So they got on the red car and came down to Long Beach. And the place they rented was over on Cedar and Pacific Coast Highway. So it was only a couple of blocks from Long Beach Boulevard at that time. So it was American Avenue, but now it's Long Beach Boulevard. But they walked down to the house and they went to the store and got food and stuff and cooked up a big dinner and said, "We're going to surprise him." So he never did show. And then finally they said, "Well, we need to call the police, find out what's wrong." Because the next night came, rolled around next morning, he still wasn't there. So they called the police department. And they said, "Well, yeah, he was down here in a police lineup." And said, "A police lineup for what?" Said they was looking for a rapist. Somebody raped this white woman. They found out, and they had a lot of black guys in the lineup, including my grandfather. And then they found out the woman was lying because her boyfriend had beat her up, and she faked like she'd been raped, you know. And then they had all these black getting ready to blame it on somebody. So that's when my grandpa and my mother told us, "Man, this is a Ku Klux Klan town." See, "You familiar with the Klans, you know, being from Arkansas?" He said, "Yep." And I've seen pictures here, like in the last 2 years, my brother-in-law was my brother and I, Jordan High School, invited us to talk about our dad. And it was the Long Beach Athletic Club on Long Beach Boulevard at the end of Cherry Avenue. We walk in the place and they said, "Well, the kitchen area is down in the back." So we went around to the right and started down there. And I looked on the wall, and here's a picture of the Long Beach Police Department. The whole department must have been about 25 or 30 members, and abreast the four. And then behind them, they had this Klansman. He had his Halloween hat on, everything, full regalia, and he was carrying the American flag. And then behind him, what is about 50 or 60 Klansmen, and they all were masked, though. You couldn't see their face. And they paraded down Ocean and to Recreation Park and found out that the Klan had the biggest rally that they'd ever had. It was over, they boasted 25,000 members out there. So we know at that time, you know, the police, you know, they had the Jim Crow Jim Crow laws, because my dad said they would stop you if they saw you on the street, a black person, they stop you, say, hey, boy, you got a job? Well, no. All right, you're under arrest. They take them down and take them before the magistrate. And he said, well, it's a $5 fine. I think it was 10 bucks. And the guy said, I don't want on no job. And I just got it. I don't have no $10. He said, well, you have to work it off. And you know, Long Beach was a kind of farm community where these dairy farms out there. So you'd have to go out there and work on somebody's farm until you paid off that fine. So that was the one thing he didn't like. He was going to try to fight that. And then that's when my mother convinced him. So, you know, you always talking about you feel some kind of connection with the NAACP because you, you know, they were formed in 1909. You were born in 1909. Tracks and say, why don't you form a branch? You know, you got a lot of members out there, a lot of people, you know, because he was managing the baseball teams, and every Sunday they let church out even early so everybody could go watch the ball game, because that's what Long Beach did for entertainment. And so he got his members, LJ Jones, Roscoe Hayes, and Nathan Holly, to say, we got to get 50 members and sent off for a national charter. So in 1940, they did that, and on October 14th, they received the charter. So they took that, and then that's when he started. She said, now you got something to fight with. And then one of the first things I remember as a kid, when I was about 7 years old, we picketed an elementary school here in Long Beach, because the Long Beach Unified School District would put on these black minstrel shows to raise money. And boy, people would pack in there. They thought it was so funny, but there's very few things I saw my dad where he hated, boy, and that was one of them. I mean, he despised that the minstrel show, and he didn't think it was funny. So I remember 7 years old, me and my older sister Barbara, because she was like about 10, because he had his own little mimeograph machines where we could make flyers and posters and stuff. And we made up all these flyers. And so the night of the minstrel show, the place was over here on Phillips. It was right off of Cherry and South Street. So we marching up and down there, people coming. I try to give them a flyer. Some of them would throw it on the ground. A lot of them would keep it and read it. And so I heard the screeching tires and the engine revved up coming down the street and slammed on the brakes. And this big old police officer got out. And then, you know, they had them big 38 Smith & Wessons. Big old gun looked like one of them cowboy guns, what they carried. And the cop got out and he put his hand on his gun. He said, what you boys doing out here? And man, my heart, like a 6-7 year, I'm about to panic, faint. My dad dropped those flyers and took a step towards him, and it must have startled him because he stopped and backed up. And he said, what you doing out there? My dad said, we out here protesting our rights as American citizens not to be made to look like buffoons. You know, why you put on these blackface minstrel shows, because it's not funny and we don't like it and we want it to stop. Man, and the cop looked at him. I said, damn, he probably gonna shoot him now. And he said, well, what you do, don't block the driveway, and before you guys leave, pick up those flyers. And he got back in his car. Man, and I always remember that. I said, I can't. My dad faced down a policeman with a gun, you know. So and about that time, with all that commotion, this guy come out of there. I think his name was, I can't remember his name, but he was president of the White Ministers Alliance in Long Beach. And he was also a president of Long Beach City College at that time. So this was in like 44, 45. And he said, well, and my dad explained it to him, said, I don't like it. He was the one putting it on. He said, because we put this on, you know, to raise money and all that. My dad told him, said, well, it's not funny and we don't think it's funny. And he said, well, I got black friends that can come and you know, do this. He said, well, you should get them, say, because this is not funny, painting yourself, because no black people look like that. So he told my dad, he said, well, we have a meeting next Tuesday, you know, at the church. He gave him the name, the address to the church. He said, you come down there and talk to the ministers and see what they got to say. So my dad said, okay. So we picked up our flyers and all that, and we got in the car and we come on home. That next week, he went to the meeting and they voted to stop it. After he explained to them what he didn't like about it and it wasn't funny, then they stopped it. So that was kind of my first experience with walking picket lines with him, because he would have our family. I think everybody in our family, even Carl here, who's 10 years after me, he had to walk his share of the lines too. So that was kind of the first thing I remember. And then after that, I remember he was able to have a supermarket chain that didn't want to hire black cashiers. And so they said, well, the NAACP found out that about 82% of their clientele was black people that lived in Cabrillo Homes or Cabrillo 3 over on Harbor and PCH, and said, well, you know, all these people, so we're going to boycott it, because they went and had a meeting with the owner. His name was Cole, because it was Cole's Market, and he owned like two markets in Long Beach where everybody shopped at. You know, it was one on Cherry and Anaheim, the other, this was on Santa Fe and 15th Street or something like that. So they coming in and had a meeting with him, and he telling my dad, he said, you know, I'm not, black people's all they're good for is mopping floors and cleaning latrines and stuff. And say, I'm not letting no black person touch my money. So my dad said, well, you're right, Mr. Cole said, we're good at cleaning latrine and mopping floors and shining shoes, because that's all we're allowed to do, but we can do more than that. And he said, well, I'm not letting no black person touch my money. So my dad got up, walked out and meet him and I think Nathan Holly, Mr. Charles Watkins, who was the first NAACP president of Long Beach, they walked out of the meeting. So they put up the picket line. And at that time, my dad, he was part of the, because back in, this was in the 50s, but see, back in 1931, when he first come to Long Beach, he got a job at Ralph's Grocery Store on 10th and Cherry. And so he was working there and he met like Billie Jean King's, the tennis player, her father, he worked there, he met those guys. So he formed a softball team, and then those guys weren't getting paid. So he protested to the owner, we need to form a union, like a retail Kirkland union, and put pressure on Ralph, the owner. And so they end up had to do it when he got all these guys to sign on for it. You know, all of them being white, he's the only black guy. And they decided to make like three different tiers, like a beginning and an intermediate and then a top tier with a white. Everybody got in the top tier and some of them the intermediate tier, and he was in the bottom. They put him in the bottom, although he worked there longer than most of the guys there. So he kind of befriended them, and then those were guys. And then by the CIO union, the union guy, because he was a West Coast representative at one time, and they told him, say, hey, that market that you picketing, we can work with and help you out. And he said, no, I don't want no white guys. We're going to do it ourselves, the black people. So he just had blacks doing the picketing. And then come find out one day, some people were sneaking in the back door. So the manager come out there and talk to my dad once. He said, you know, Ernie, Mr. Coldboy, you're really putting a hurt on our business, because we done lost about 80% of our business since you guys put this picket line out. But there was people sneaking in the back door and they didn't know. He told my dad, so there's people sneaking in the back. And so they put one up in the back, you know, and caught them people that were sneaking in buying groceries. Because most of the people that catered to them lived in Cabrillo 3, you know, most of the blacks. But he told them, say, you got Mr. Cole on his knees. So then finally they had another meeting. It took like 9 months. And they had another meeting and they say, well, okay, we'll send you, you know, if you need a cashier, we'll try to hire one. And then my wife's brother, her middle brother at that time, he lived across the street from us on Lemon. And we told him about it, man. He said, yeah, they're looking for a check, somebody they're going to train you. He went down there and was the first black that got hired as a checker. So he got him a job. He was kind of dating my sister, my older sister at that time. So that was the second thing. They integrated that. And then I think Dad had really gotten a reputation in Long Beach. And he would go around and send people around in his companies. They got any black people working in there? Nope. Some of them, he'd go in there and they say, oh, Lord, here come McBride. We better hire somebody to keep from dealing with him, you know. And then I think the toughest job he got was trying to get a black police officer hired. Because he said even in Little Rock, they had a black police officer. And he'd be patrolling. Then on Saturday night when all the people got drunk and all the shooting started, he'd run in this printing press company and hide behind the machines till all the shooting stopped. And then he'd come out there and Dad said, look for somebody's head to whip on so he could arrest them, you know, to make himself look good. So he said, we might not get a good one, but at least we'll break in that organization. So he had this guy, Walt McCown, was a football star at Poly High School. And he was like, they had a class president and a vice president, then they had a sergeant of arms. Well, Walt was always elected a sergeant of arms his years in high school. So my dad said, well, you'd probably be a good candidate, good grades, be a good candidate. So they tried to pick up the, you know, he'd go down, talk to the police department, stuff to try to hire black, and we don't have nobody qualified. So they sent Walt, and he took the test, and I think he come out third or fourth on the test out of about 20 or 30 people. And when it come to taking the physical, now here's an all-star football player, when it come, made all California high school, and when it come to the physical, they talking about he didn't pass because he had bad blood. So that blocked him out. So Walt got mad. He ended up getting a 4-year scholarship to Loyola and got his degree and went into business, you know. And my dad couldn't get him. So yeah, you. He said, nah, forget the police department. You know, they pull that on me. I don't be bothering. So they got another black guy named Dubois. They didn't get him, but they told the blacks about it. Go down there and put in for the job. Cause my dad would always say, hey, I don't recommend anybody. I just tell them about it and let them go. Because if he realized if you recommend a black person, they go down there and do bad, then it's a reflection on you. Well, we did what you said, but this Negro couldn't pass the test. So anyway, that fight lasted from 1940, because my dad even talked to a doctor. My doctor, pediatrician that we had at that time, he was a family doctor, but his name was Dr. Hiller, German doctor. And he said, Max, ain't nothing wrong with his blood. So you come and say, if you want me to, I'll go down there and vouch for him. So that's when Walt didn't want to push it. And he said, no, I'm not going to apply no more. I'm going to just moved to Fresno. He opened up a pool hall business and went on to Fresno. So that was the second thing that Dad got done. And it took to like 43 to 1948 before he got a black hire, Dubois. And he was one like Dad say, he'd whip on your head in a minute to to build a reputation, you know, which he had a reputation among the teenagers in Long Beach. And then that was the second thing. And then the third thing, they had a General Telephone Company, which is now owned by Verizon. It's located over there by Long Beach City College on Lou Davis Avenue and Clark. They didn't have any black clerk typists, you know, working for them, no blacks. So my dad said, hey, talk to my older sister Barbara, said, don't you have some girls friends you know that can type real good, and I'm gonna send them down there because we got to integrate this place. And she said, well, I'll look around. So she found a girl that was looking for a job. Yeah. And say, well, take her down there. So, and I want you to go down there with them, monitor the tests, see what they're trying to pull on the test, because they didn't trust the testing, you know. And so she went down there, and the people said, well, you can't go in the test room with her. You have to, if you go in there, you have to take the test too. If you just, even though you want to just monitor her. So she said, okay. So she goes in, take the test. When the results came out the next day, my sister passed, and the girl she brought failed it. So boy, and when dad heard that, so they said, well, we're ready to hire, you know, because she, your daughter passed it. So my sister said, no, I'm working at Arnold's restaurant as a waitress, and I'm making like the, I think she's making like $1.25 an hour. And say that job only paying like $1.10. And I'm not going to take no demotion like that. I tease about this today. And my dad said, well, you know, because he was a good mechanic, and because he could do electricals, because he had went to a night school to study electrician. He was an electrician. He could do plumbing. And he was a carpenter, because him and his dad used to build houses in Little Rock when they were in Arkansas. And so he had all those different trades. And so he told Barbara, said, well, you know, if you you know, your car could break down again, you're going to need somebody to fix it. And all that. So he basically blackmailed her into quitting that job at Arnold's and integrating the telephone company. So she did. He said, you can just work there long enough for them to hire some more, and then you can quit. So she worked about 4 or 5 months, and then they hired another black girl, Gloria Valeda Atkinson, who I knew. And then she eventually worked her way up to supervisor Valeda, you know, like 25 years or so later. But then my sister Barbara worked there for about the 3 or 4 months, and then she quit and went back to Arnold's. Arnold's was in Maybelle, California, but they had moved out to Seal Belmont Shore. And they said, yeah, Barbara, we got a job. And they sent out the Belmont Shore, and she got a other job back, you know, but at a different location, which was close to the home. But that was probably the third thing integrated. And then in the 40s, before that, how they came up with two different presidents was like the Long Beach Naval Dry Docks before it became the shipyard in like 49. Well, back in the 40s, it was the Long Beach Naval Dry Dock, where they had an electricians union, and no blacks were in it. So Nathan Holley and my dad, and I think it was Roscoe Hayes, they went out there to talk to the union. Yeah, well, you got to be in the union, first of all, and there was no blacks in the union. So they went out there to met with the union, said, we want to join up. Said, well, you got to have $10 or something like that. And I think Holly was the only one that had 10 bucks on him at that time to join up. But then they said, well, you represent the NAACP, you got to be the minister. So Holly was saying, well, I'm the president. And then my dad said, well, I'm the field secretary. And Roscoe Hayes was saying, I'm just one of the members. And so they integrated that union, but they stayed on him from that time up until about 1943. And, you know, the reason he took that job from, because he, prior to that, he was working at Ralph's from 1931 up to about 1941 when this shipyard job, because when the draft came, they would say, hey, even though you got in 41, I guess we had all, you weren't born yet. Yeah. Barbara and I, well, it was just us two. Even though you got two kids, you eligible for the draft unless you work for the Department of Defense doing something for defense. And then Ralph's could qualify, you know, being a market, food, providing food for people, you could qualify as a, you know, helping the war effort. But the union, the manager out there didn't like him because he had formed a union, so they wouldn't write him no recommendation. So that was one of the reasons he quit Ralph's in like 41 and hired in with the shipyard at the dry docks, you know, so he would avoid the draft. So those were the kind of the things I vividly and used to talk to him about. And then I found out the reason he was so vehemently, you know, opposed trying to break down the discrimination, because that Jim Crow laws was alive and well here in Long Beach.
Oh, hey, Ernest.
Yes. Ernest,
appreciate what you said, if I understand correctly, and we're going to come back to you, but Carl, do you have any comment?
Yeah, about the school.
Well, you know, I'm 10 years younger, so I was really behind the curve with most of the information. You said yes. Any of the historical information. I just remember him as a hard worker. He worked day and night. He'd do the NAACP work at night and evenings. He was a craftsman. He was good with his hands. So he helped a lot of people in the neighborhood who had broken windows. You know, a white man wasn't going to fix anything wrong with the property once while he was renting it to you. So he was very helpful and going fixing water. He put in water heaters, broken windows. He would fix all that. So he was quite busy.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of the things too, you know, the police used to try to get the, when we lived on 17th, boy, they would, every time there was the NAACP meeting at the house, the police would show up and they'd be walking up and down the side of the house, and it was old rickety fence, and it was hardly enough room for two people to pass each other. And you'd hear these sounds, and my sister, she's about 7, I was about 3 or 4. And I said, somebody out there. And she go in there and tell dad, dad, there's somebody behind the house. And it was pitch black back there, even with the porch light. We didn't turn the porch light on, because we lived in the rear. And you could come right off the alley and walk right down the back of the house. So he go out there, and it'd be 7 or 8 police officers out there. And he'd say, what you fellas doing? Oh, we got a call of a prowler in the neighborhood, and we come to check it out. They want to try to find out who was in the meeting. So he'd invite them in. Come on in. You guys sitting out there, it was cold and stuff. You can come on in and listen. And they come in, look around, and they would leave. And they always tried to tell them, say, well, hey, we want to see the members list, because they was intercepting the mail at the Long Beach Post Office. You know, anything NAACP, they'd intercept that mail, turn it over to the police before they deliver it. And so he would always had all these members in the CIO union. And when he sent out cards for meeting, boy, he sent out maybe 50, 75 cards. But he never, and then the thing that, what he ended up on a lot of things, the reason our family end up being the ones protesting, because a lot of the other people, their jobs were threatened. Because, see, they wanted to know, you know, most, at that time, black people, you only did house cleaning, or you worked in the hotels, that Wilton Hotel down there, or you cleaned somebody's house. And then the men, it was either shoe shining or janitor work, you know. And so no decent jobs until he got on the city and got the police officer hired. And then that opened it up for the fire department and the rest of city employment. because the only black, when he came in 1930, the only black person that worked for the city of Long Beach was a Mr. Levi Howard. And his wife, we call her Mother Howard, but they owned a big apartment building there on 12th and Martin Luther King Avenue. They owned that apartment complex there. And when black people come to town, they would tell you, if you were single, you had to go to Mr. Howard's. That's where you could stay, because he had it broken up in rooms where he had about 15 or 20 rooms. So you had to go over there. But unless you own property, and there were some blacks that owned places, but otherwise you couldn't stay. That's what me and my mom had to go to Wilmington, because you know, with restrictive covenants and stuff, you couldn't stay in Long Beach. A black person couldn't. That's how he kind of protected a lot of people that weren't in NAACP, because like he said, we know we have more than 50 members, because that's what we had to have to start out. But then most people worked for white people, you know, you work cleaning up the house, or you work downtown at the hotel, so they put pressure on your job. So most of these people, the kind of the work they did was invisible. But he was always out front, because he worked in the community. You know, people get plumbing problems, boy, they call him, any kind of problems. Well, he did it, and that's how he made his money. So he said, okay, I'm making more money here than when I was a junior mechanic over at Cotton Smoller Ford's, you know, in Wilmington.
Yeah, handyman.
That job, yeah.
Yeah, handyman. Willie Martin. Junior or senior, y'all have any comments? Is Carol there? Take yourself off mute. Willie Martin, are you there?
Carol should be there.
Carol, you there? Okay. What about Nicole Garrett?
Gravett.
Nicole?
All right, Nicole.
You got to take yourself off mute.
I'm here. Oh. I just wanted to say, every day that I miss my grandfather every day, and I know it's been years and years, and he was such a blessing, and he was such a wonderful individual, and I'm all grateful that he was brave enough to accomplish all that he did. And I know that that's where a lot of residents from Long Beach have benefited from his bravery.
Yes, that's a good word. Yeah.
Yeah, that's okay. One other thing there too, I almost forgot, like Mr. Charles Watkins, well, his photo's in that group, but he looked like a white, a lot of people would think he was white. Well, he worked, my dad would never tell me, because what happened in Long Beach, the police department put out a hit on it. They said, we need you to get rid of that McBride and get rid of Nathan Holley and Roscoe Hayes. And Croom, Joe Croom. So we want to get rid of them four. Well, yeah. Croom left town, went back to Alabama, and Nathan Holley moved up to L.A., broke out in. So my dad, he was here to face the music alone. He said, because with my big family, there's nowhere I can go. But if they want me, they got me. But Charles Watkins told him years later, he said, man, these about five or six officers got on the elevator and we was riding down. They was talking about this. Said, we need to get that McBride and Joe Croom and Nathan Holley. And so the hell, you know, so they had their head out on us. So Mr. Watkins told him, said, look, Mac, wherever you go at night, don't go alone. Always have somebody with you.
That's good. Hey, Willie, y'all, yes. Go ahead.
Yeah. I would just like to say that Ernest McBride Sr. and Ernest McBride Jr. I was so impressed with Mr. McBride. I'd come over to see his youngest daughter, Carol, and I would end up listening to him. Mm-hmm. He was instrumental in some of the work that I had done in the community. He was my example. And the thing that I'm really impressed with is a high school called Ernest McBride High School. Mm-hmm. The house he had on Lemon has a monument, a plaque that the city gave him. I mean, a man that came from his background and achieved the things, it's mind-boggling. And he's probably impressing me as much as anyone.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, you know, Willie, you know, you got a legacy yourself. And you at 555, you, Jimmy Swan, and all the brothers and sisters that worked there. And you're standing on the shoulders of Mr. McBride. I didn't meet him until 1968 when I came out there through Martinville them. And I'm going to give you my position in a little minute. What about Evan Walker? Any comment?
Carol Walker, yeah.
Is that Carol Walker? Well, it got Evan on it. I guess that's the computer name. All right.
Hello. Hello, I'm his godson, and I'm just coming on to support my god-grandfather.
Okay, good, Evan, and we appreciate that. Anyone else want to make a comment?
Yeah, I'll make a comment. My name is Carol. I'm Evan's mother, and like he said, Mr. McBride and Mama McBride has been an example. My kids didn't have, you know, grandfathers growing up. They had passed on, but he's been an example. But one of the things that I really want to say is, how do we get these kids today to hear about this history? Because I'm a preschool teacher and I know other teachers, and our children just don't know about like what others have done to get us where we are. So what can we do to get this word out? Like this story about Mr. McBride, because I didn't get to meet him. I think he had passed. I've known Nicole. Nicole's my best friend for about 30 years. So I didn't get to meet him, but wow, what an incredible man. And so my question is to some of the panel, you know, you and other people, how do we get our teenagers and our college students to learn about this history?
Okay, that's a good question. And I'm gonna see if anybody else wanna try to answer it. Brother Hembrick, are you still there? And what about you, Rasha Key?
Yes. Well, we have the Community Education Network that's online right here that I'm sharing on the screen. And we have these programs every week. If you have the podcast on the website, mm-hmm. and you have audio, all the shows on audio, mm-hmm. then also, we have the YouTube channel, which most people are on YouTube. Mm-hmm. And let me share that also. Bear with me. Okay. Here's the YouTube channel right here.
Oh, community.
And you see, we have 550 videos.
Wow.
The one tonight will be 551. And we have, you can say we have a historical archive here, because we did eight straight weeks on the Conscious Corner. Wow. Of the history of the Black Studies program at Long Beach State. We did 8 weeks of that. And Ernest McBride Jr. was on there too, mm-hmm. giving us historical information. So there's a lot of information out there. It's who's going to direct the children to it, who's going to expose them. We also are offering for younger people to come on and do things with us also. So we've been in circulation for 4 years now. So that's one avenue. to get them to learn history, local history, in Long Beach, Compton, Los Angeles. And we also feature people basically all over the United States. And we have a connection in Africa also, in Ghana. Mm-hmm. We had a few guests from Ghana on here. So we're constantly putting content out that's historical.
All right. Brother Hembrick, did you want to say anything? He's a former college, a high school administrator and teacher and counselor and coach. He's a first black varsity football coach for Linwood Unified, as well as an administrator, teacher, and a historian. Joe, how would you answer that question?
I would say just teacher. She says she's a preschool teacher, right? So, Brian, you can bring a picture of those elders and just teach them what you got.
Mm-hmm.
Got a picture of him, you know what he's done, and just let the kids know.
Carol, that's a good question. I'm gonna be real brief. You have to, because I was a teacher and I taught on all levels. It's not easy teaching preschool, the cognitiveness, and some parents don't want you to teach them certain things about history and about life. So you have to find ways, clever ways of doing it. They got a lot of good cartoons out that have messages in it about history. We're going to have a brother, Daryl Grayson, on. He used to produce for BET animated cartoons about our history and our culture. Second, you have to know your environment, your principal support, environment support, because a lot of the schools now are majority Latino, and it's very challenging trying to teach the few Black people in the midst of Latino sacred knowledge and historical knowledge. And a lot of them Latinos are diverse. They're not all from Mexico, not all from LA, El Salvador, Nicaragua. And so it's very challenging to do that now. The best way to teach the young people, start at home with your own kids, because sometimes we have a tendency to say what other people need, but we need it for our own children. That's why some of them go astray. But you're doing a good job as far as answering that question on how to get it done. And you got to come up with your strategy, because you know where you are and you know how to present the material without people being offended and feeling left out or that you're racist, And so it's clever. But if you come on and that Rasha Key has invited you, probably give you some pointers on how to get that information, because Carter G. Woodson always said we're miseducated, not only in the schools, but even at home, because many of our parents wouldn't talk about it. It wasn't like the McBride family that had a father that, was instrumental in the civil rights movement. Most of our parents just want to feed, clothe us, and let us live our lives, but and if it ain't a church, a mosque or a synagogue, they won't take you anywhere else. But they do have Black museums, taking kids on field trip, the African American Museum. They're gonna try to shut all that down. They're trying to shut the one in National, the biggest one they just built. Trump them trying to shut that one down. Let me just go over quickly my experience with Mr. McBride Sr. I came to Long Beach in 1968 to play basketball, go to Long Beach State, but I was an activist when I came there. So somehow, either through Martinville or through Willie and them, I ended up going by Mr. McBride's house. And I think Martin was running buddies at that time. So I went over there and we got to talking, and his house was a center. It was like a community center where you go and get wisdom and discuss things, because he was always able to give you examples by how he lived with his family and loved them as a family person. And that inspired the other people to be strong. As he educated people, he also was able to mobilize families. When you talk about the Croons, you talk about the Andrews, you talk about the various families in the neighborhood. See, that was pre-gang, gang street, gang notorious. You know, so families were notorious. I mean, you know, they stuck together. It was concentrated in Long Beach. And so Mr. McBride was one of the bravest persons, as Nicole said, because even though he was doing what was right, he had experience where they hung people, as Ernest was saying, and drug them for no reason. But when he came out here, there was a Black movement that liberated Black people to stand up. He was standing up already, but it gave him strength to even stand up even more and be more bodacious because of the Black movement that was going on in the 60s. And he was a rare politician that did not go to Mr. McBride seeking his endorsement. Especially Ms. McDonald, Congresswoman Ms. McDonald, and others. He was instrumental in getting the first Black city councilman elected. I really think he could have ran for office himself, but for whatever reason, he didn't do it. But at the same time, it was a gathering not only for the seniors and a role model for other families to emulate, because all his children were hardworking. Carl was a hard worker, you understand? And Carol and the other sisters, they were all hard workers from his example. And they were also the beauty and the engine in the communities as far as people loving and caring for him. He was so powerful, white folks not only put a hit out on him, but accused him of being communist and put him on COINTELPRO, counterintelligence program. I'm hoping that one day there will, as under the Freedom of Information Act, present to the Long Beach Department, the FBI, and everybody, and get a report back on the surveillance. Yeah. Their surveillance, if they haven't done it, you know, and print this stuff, because as Carol said, Nicole said, Carol, that, you know, people need to know this history, that people actually, because they were standing up for what was right, they had a tendency to think that they weren't in danger. So they were just asking for just minimum rights, just the right. Rob, yes.
Not to interrupt, but this picture here is a picture of Benjamin Hooks.
Yeah, I remember Benjamin Hooks.
National president. And what brought him out here was that accusation that our dad was a communist, right? And was running the party. So he come out in, sit down, had a meeting with them. And then at the end of the meeting, he told my dad, say, everything you've been doing, you keep on doing it, because that's what this organization is all about. And so that got rid of that, you know.
Yeah. Benjamin is a strong brother. He was over at FCC. And well, is that Frank Berry with him?
Frank Berry
was president.
He was president of the local branch at that time.
But see, families were strong. If you get the father, when you get people to stand up, because you stand up, that makes them feel comfortable. And what Long Beach needed was somebody to stand up. And Mr. McBride started the Optima Club, as well as the NAACP. And I remember he had me speak at the Optima Club. And I just adore the man because of his bravery and the challenges that sometimes he didn't know that they were trying to undermine him, the FBI and all the other people. But at the same time, his family was an institution at the same time. Everybody, they married each other locally, neighbors and stuff. And it was just a beautiful thing to see. And he was such a great humanitarian. And we used to play cards in the back of one of his properties. Me, Joe Ware, William Martin, I think Yak.
Mohair, yeah.
Mohair, all of them brothers. And it was a beautiful setting. But at the same time, we respected this place as a sacred place to go. And you felt safe there. And you left there with energy. And this work. Go ahead.
Mention my mother's grandmother, our great grandmother, because that was Ville's, that's Mark Ville's daddy, right? Yeah. There. And that's his grandmother. She lived to be 110. So,
well, I wish I had some of her genes.
Mark got a longevity in his family.
Yeah, and see, that's the thing about civil rights workers. They think they're doing it, and all you're asking for is the man to live up to his word, his constitution, that all people are supposed to be treated fairly. So you never thought that would get you killed or get you undermined. Martin Luther King didn't think. I mean, he knew he was in danger because of the South. But, you think you're standing up and doing God's work and doing the right, your work for the people, even though you may not benefit from it. But William Martin, the Giles family, Bobby Rose was a hell of a man. You understand? It was just a beautiful community. And what made it beautiful was the McBride family, because they set an example for all the other families, for many of them. Some didn't participate, but a lot of them did. So Ernest, if you have some closing comments, go ahead. And we may have to do a part two to get to the other stuff.
I've sent Mr. Rashankani that kind of quote that my dad used to say at the end, if you couldn't, if he could bring that up. It's the written stuff in the red, yeah.
And that white, and the lady in the white, that's your mom, that's his wife, right?
That's mom, yeah.
Yeah, I remember her.
Yeah, that's our mom. It's Miss Annabelle Cohen, and my mother, Lillian McBride. This is Miss Ernestine Cheatham, and this is Mr. Hildren Cheatham. He was Optimus when they first formed the Optimus. He was the first president, I think. And then Mr. Percy Anderson. He was president of the NAACP also.
And yeah, and Percy was a strong minister. He helped get that monument finished in King Park. Mm-hmm. And he had to go in his own pocket. But Percy, his son, is a FBI. A federal judge now. Went to Polly.
Mr. Anderson.
Yeah.
Rob, yeah. We did go to the Freedom of Information Act, and we got a file where they followed him from 1940 to 1964.
But see, and this is, now that's positive, but it's also scary for a lot of people.
And a lot of people was probably caught up in there too.
Yeah, well, they blocked out about 20 pages they didn't send us. They were redacted.
Heavily redacted.
We did. And the Long Beach Police Department says, well, we got nothing. Sent me a letter when I put in. They said, we got nothing on them. And I thought to myself, that's bull. As much as you used to be hanging outside our window listening, you had to have something.
Yeah. Well, like they said, man, you can't get mad at a snake for crawling on his belly. Right. And they were snakes up there in Long Beach.
Yeah.
But go ahead, Ernest, or anybody else.
That was one of his favorite inspirational messages. He would say, I feel people will always go the right direction. It may take a long time, but in the long run, they will do the right thing. And he thinks man was put here to glorify the earth. And if you can't do something to help somebody, you haven't contributed. If I've contributed, I feel I'm blessed for doing so. So that was one of his favorite things. Okay.
You're on mute, Rob.
Oh, hey, Ernest, I want to tell you, man, we really appreciate you being an example for other offsprings.
I enjoy
a family tree, but your family tree is different.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really an archive, saving newspaper articles, pictures. I mean, that's a beautiful thing, man. We want to commend you for that work. That's not easy to go do all that research and to maintain it and to keep it in a structure in which you not only doing it for the family, but you're honoring your father at the same time. A lot of people don't remember the scripture say, honor your mother and father so your days will be long. And you're doing that, brother. You live long enough that to inspire Nicole, Carol, and all the individuals that's on this show today to hopefully they'll be inspired. That they're looking to their family and find out all the richness of their family. You're going to find some mess. All of us got issues in families, but at the same time, it's a beautiful thing what you've done. And we really appreciate it. And in closing, Rotsky, you want to tell us what's coming on tomorrow?
Okay, I appreciate you having us, Jeff.
Let me see. All right, we got Dr. Inky Reels coming on for about the fourth time. He's originally from New York. He's been on the podcast scene for a while, and he's a naturopathic doctor. So he's going to talk about bone regeneration. That's tomorrow. So and if anybody's interested, all you have to do is go to the website and click right there. You'll be right on.
And for anybody that missed this podcast, Zoomcast, we are. It's on YouTube. It will be on YouTube probably by tomorrow. Rasha T edited it, and then we put it up. So any family member that missed the presentation, you can do it. And Nicole, also, you could probably get okay to play the history and legacy of Mr. McBride in your classes. In your classroom, Carol. I can't remember which one was the teacher.
It was Carol.
Yeah. And you might they'll do that because he has a school named after him, he has a park named after him, he got a plaque in front of his yard. I mean, he's loved and respected for his contribution. It's just a beautiful thing.
Teen Center and
he had the whole wreck.
Everybody says the wreck, and I got to correct them. And I said, where's the wreck? And they, you know what the wreck is. Is that the McBride part? You know, so you'll know. Yeah. But another great thing he had was his life history was read in the 104th Congressional Record.
Good.
By Stephen Horn, who was president.
And the historymakers.com.
Historymakers.com, yeah.
Well, we know. I mean, the accolades are good. But his work is even better. That earned him the accolade. They don't do that for people that do nothing. He did something. He made a difference. And these people in Long Beach, from P&G to the record stores and to Frank Berry has a record store.
Yeah.
VIP, all of that stuff. Coleman's Market, Kelly's Bookstore. All of those things were right there centered. And don't forget the legacy of Long Beach Poly before they opened up the school district where blacks can go anywhere. And because Poly was the center of producing not only strong athletes, but strong activists and strong community unity because the families supported the sports so much they would meet there and have a beautiful time. And some of them still go there. Some of them are boosters. And they still attend. Mm-hmm. And you know, that Long Beach community is a model to emulate all around. And you had the 21st Street Crips and all that now, but that's America corrupting our kids. You know, gangsterism started with America. There ain't no difference between the Democrat and Republican. One wear red, one wear blue. It's all political gangbang. You understand? And there's so much that we can learn, but I just wish we could have recorded some of the conversations we had with Mr. McBride at his house. I knew I grew from him. He inspired me. I know he inspired his kids because I know him and I see him. And they all were community activists in many ways. So Ernest, you know, you're a treasure. I want to, my brother Joe Hembrick, he's a treasure. And we had Linda Shorter on for a little while. She's out of Florida. She's a regular. Machinda's a regular. He's a regular. And I'm hoping that all of us learn from this this historical lesson about Mr. McBride Sr. And what his contribution was. There's a lot of unsung heroes that didn't get on the international scene. But I'm hoping that one day that his teaching, his work be taught in every Long Beach school and spread to other schools by the teachers. So we're gonna tell each and every one of you, as Rasha Key said, you find your family in a peaceful place. You're welcome to come and join us in. And if you have anything you want to discuss or anything that you want to bring up, just contact me or you can contact Ernest now and we'll put you on. If you want to talk about male-female relationships, if you want to talk about the drug problem in our community, the gang problem, the political problem, the educational problem, and even, you know, any issue that you think that need to be out there discussed, you're welcome to come on. And you just contact us and we'll figure out when you can come on our calendar. So Rasha Key, again, we want to welcome everybody and encourage them to tune in and look at our archive on the audio and also the archives on YouTube. All our shows are on there. And so you can share it with other people. And we really appreciate all of you to tune in to hear this historical and well-deserved presentation by Ernest McBride Jr. because he set an example of what we all should be doing is keeping our history of our family, our mothers, our fathers, the good and the bad, and just keep it so the other kids can learn from it. Because they think life began when they were born and they don't know what the struggles we've been through. And they think we ATMs or Cash App. And that's it. You know, and we got to get out of that and teach them some sense that life ain't easy. Life, things that happen that you're not expecting, they'll knock you down. And you got to be able to withstand it. You can't, you know, it ain't about me, myself, and I. It's about all of us. When one hurt, all hurt. And I really enjoyed meeting Nicole and Carol because I never got a chance to meet the grandkids. But I can tell you this, boy, you come from a good stock. You got good genes in you. And that's why y'all are teachers and professionals yourself. All right, we're going to close out. All right, Carl, I'll call you later.
Here's my granddaughter here. She's going to get all my photos for me.
And we really appreciate you, sister. Helping your pawpaw.
And that was me that called.
Oh. Sorry about that. I'm sorry. he called earlier.
Oh.
Hello.
Yes.
I didn't know.
Hello.
Okay.
Hi.
Mr. Marshall.
How are you?
I want to just thank my brothers for doing such an outstanding presentation.
Thank you.
Yeah, we're going to have him do this.
They say I'm too long when I get wound up, so I have to have Carl to poke me.
We know.
Shut up.
but it's good trouble. It's good trouble. Hey, Carol, everything okay?
Yeah.
All right, then.
Yeah, everything is fine.
All right, then. I'll give you one that call a little later.
Each one teach one.
All right.
Each one teach one in Conscious Corner.
All right. Okay.
Thanks for being here.
All right. Thank you.
Got Willie Jr. watching. He's got some real good information now.
Right. Willie Jr. Okay. Little Willie Jr. My former student.
Yeah.
Brother, man, I miss you, brother.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Are you doing good things?
And, yes,
made a beautiful transformation. I appreciate that.
He teaching his son to come up.
Yeah. Well, he got a lot to teach.
Yeah,
he's been through it.
All right.
All right, y'all, just get.